Coming up on This Week in Space, Rod and I are going to talk about Boeing Starliner crew flight test. Finally, Boeing is ready to launch astronauts for the first time. Here's what to know and what to look out for. Tune in.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 108, recorded on April 26, 2024. Starliner, better late than never. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the Starliner at Last Edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief, Van Astor Magazine, and I'm here, as always, with Tarek Malik, the iconoclastic editor-in-chief of space.com. Hello, sir.
Hello, Rod. Starliner. Woo! I'm wearing my shirt. Let's go.
So you say. Well, we'll see. Before we start, I would like to remind everybody to please do us a solid. Make sure to like, subscribe, and other podcast things, because we need to know that we have your love. And now, a space joke from listener Scott Ulrich.
Scott!
An alien visiting Earth was hungry and walked into the Apple store. A few moments later, he was choking and died on the spot.
Oh, no.
When the police interviewed the store clerk, he shrugged and replied, "I just told him that model was only a single terabyte."
Terabyte, because it's Earth.
Yes. Thank you, Scott. Thank you, everybody. And don't forget to save us from yourselves and send us your best work or most of your space joke at twits@twit.tv. Now,
let's hope some aliens don't eat computers. That'd be really bad.
Let's get on to the important thing. I believe this week was special. Why was this week special, Tarek?
Well, I don't know, Rod. I feel like you're teeing me up for something.
Well,
so it was my birthday. Is that why?
So, it was your birthday, and not only was it your here we go.
Swing it. High and low. It's Therese Day. Let's hit the groove. Beat on that birthday move. Across the stars in moonlit space flights, laughing in our suits. While gaming hard in virtual fights and battles, Fortnites and loots. Then crash, he laughs, tips from his chair. A fun, chaotic spook. The band wails on with blaring horns. Tonight we raise the roof. Swinging through the nebula. Tariq's got his game face on, high score on the rise. With every beat, the drums are kicking, trumpets to the skies. Tap dancing on a spaceship, moonwalk without shoes.
It's
all about to blast off, it's a party not to lose. Jitterbug in the cosmos, Tariq's night shan't defer.
Aww.
Those weren't the best lyrics on the planet Earth.
Hey, no, Rod, that is great. Thank you so much. You know?
Well, and the best gift of all, sir, as you were talking before the show, is that you don't know how old you are.
That's
which is,
right.
You know, when we're old and dribbling at the old folks' home, it'll be good. Well, I'll be dead by the time you get there. But it'll be good to, you know, always be younger than you think you are.
Yeah, I was telling Rod and John and Anthony in the back room that I spent the last year thinking I was turning 48, that I was already 47 and turning 48. And then I did the math this week and realized, no, I'm actually 46 and I'm turning 47. So, whew, at least there's that. You know, I'm a little, I save one extra year before the great 50, but it's creeping up fast there. So.
And now we know why you're
excellent song.
Why you're a space journalist instead of a rocket scientist.
By the way,
I just put in that one wrong note. Oh, it blew up.
Oh, it is not lost on me how bad of an actual like astronaut or scientist I would be. You remember, I was the one that the astronomy internship put me on the kiddie computer so that I didn't overwrite any more data after I nearly erased a week's worth of observations of the sun. So yeah, maybe it's good that I just kind of observe from the rafters.
Was that in the little teeny tiny kernel sized astronomy department at USC?
Yeah, it was in like their research room, which was like a closet type thing that just was filled with Sun computers, and me and another intern who knew what he was doing, and me who didn't know what a Sun computer was or how to type the commands in or anything like that. So,
well, at least they had one. When I was briefly considering a run at USC before I decided to go to real school.
Wow.
Their astronomy department. And it was nice. You know, the people that had gone through it that I knew up at Griffith Observatory where I worked really liked it. But I do remember it was tiny. It was actually nice because it was kind of intimate. You know, it wasn't mm-hmm. a big impersonal thing like they had at UCLA.
Yeah. We got a lot of personal attention, but it does mean that if you study astronomy, at least it did like 30 years ago, whatever it was, all the classes aren't available all the time. So you have to right. take them on a rotating schedule, which meant I actually had to stay at USC for an extra semester to complete the astronomy portion of my degree process to get the minor, because I had to wait for the next class to be available. And it was only available in an extra semester. So no doubling up there. So,
well, we'll consider that to be our first headline for the day. Tarek had to stay, was held back, and it's not just in school, but in his university experience, he had the little white cone hat on, not for reasons you might think. All right, let's get to some headlines. What do you say, brother?
Yes, let's do it. Let's do it.
So Voyager, we finally got a phone call.
This is correct. So that's right. NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory announced just earlier this week that they did, in fact, after 5 months of not hearing from the Voyager spacecraft, what was it, like 11 billion miles away, something like that, out in interstellar space, that they got that little bip back from the spacecraft. So they know that they are back in contact. They know that they have the health of the spacecraft for the first time. And that's really exciting because, as we were talking about in our updates on this in the past, it is not like a fast process to try to talk to Voyager 1 out there beyond the stars. I mean, it takes
45-hour round trip.
That's right. It takes 2 days just to have one conversation. And so they had to basically isolate over the last 5 months, you know, where is the glitch? What system is it in? Oh, it's in this little bit, you know, and over time they were able to kind of get to the part where they are in communication, like where they can understand what the spacecraft is saying. It's not sending it out back the gobbledygook that it was doing before. And, you know, we're talking about 47-year-old things. This is Voyager, you know, turning 47 this year too. And so it's just amazing that they've been able to get it, because it's been, it's been since November 14th that all of this stuff really started. And
we're talking about an almost half century old computer with all the memory of a tennis shoe. You know, yeah. I mean, it's really, if you showed somebody on a pie chart what it could do versus a modern iPhone or something, you'd just fall out of your chair laughing. Oh, wait, yeah. You do that anyway. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, and there's I know that on the video side of things, we were showing the story earlier. There's a great photo there of the JPL team with their arms up, like in touchdown, you know, victory, just cheering when they got that contact restored. And I undersold it. I said 11 billion miles. No, they're like 15 billion miles out there. On the video, for folks on that side, you can see that photo now of all these engineers and scientists on the Voyager flight team.
Elderly engineers.
No, I wouldn't say. I'd say it's a good mix. So. No, bro,
but, well, I'm looking. I saw a lot of people that kind of look like they're edging up on my age, but they would be, right?
Yeah, but the work's not done, Rod. The work's not done here, because they do need to spend like the next few weeks basically adjusting the rest of this flight data software, which is where they isolated the glitch over these last few months, to recover all of the parts of that system that, you know, have to package and send back the science data that Voyager is still capable of, because it can do some. The power is very low, so it can't use all of its instruments. Right. But they want to make sure that they get that all sorted over the next few weeks. So they'll take it slow, like we said, 15 billion miles, 2 day round trip. But they're going to get there, and it seems like we're going to at least be all set for a nice 47th anniversary in what was that, in September, in August, right? Is that when they launched? July? Anyway, in the summer.
They launched across 2 months. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. China's new space station had an issue. Oh, you changed the headline. I'm sorry. China's Shenzhou 18 crew launches Tiangong space station, which was hit by a piece of space crud.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they didn't happen at the same time. This is really interesting. But the news came out kind of back to back, essentially this week, actually on my birthday, because I think that China was trying to give me a message. they launched their new crew to the internet, to the Tiangong space station. It was a 6.5 hour trip. They've got it pretty swift, like Roscosmos and SpaceX. They includes, I think, the commander, or a member of the Shenzhou 13 crew, who is the new commander, as well as two others who joined three other astronauts on the station now. So a big crew change. But this this has been going on now for several years. China now has a basically permanently crewed space station in orbit. But what we did find out just days ahead of this launch, and it came out actually during the press conference for this mission, is that the Shenzhou 17 crew, so that's the crew that was already up there, they did two spacewalks over the last few months. I think one was in like the December timeframe, and then there was one in March. And it turned out that some of the tasks on those spacewalks were to repair the actual Tiangong space station because it was struck by debris. And we don't know what. Was it like a meteoroid, or was it actual spacecraft debris, space junk, that knocked out part of the power system on the spacecraft, which you never want to have on your spacecraft. So they had to do some sort of patch-ups to fix that. It came out, and this was a report that that we had seen from both Xinhua News as well as like from Reuters and others. But it did come out that China said that they're going to develop new plans in place when it comes to space debris management. Now they're saying they're going to do this, you know, right, after they've blown up, you know, a satellite and created vast clouds of debris and just throw stuff, you know, all over the place. Now, after a piece hits their space station, now they're going to say they're going to, you know, try to rein that back in. Those were kind of two interesting things where they had this debris event at the space station, admitted that they had to fix it, and then they had a new crew that's going to be responsible for dealing with that over the next 6 months or so.
All right. And China has announced partnerships with Nicaragua, the Arab Union for Astronomy, and the Pacific Space Cooperation Organization, which is headquartered in Beijing, for the International Lunar Research Station, which is their answer to the Artemis Accords, came along a little later, is not punching quite as high as Artemis is. They have, 10 or 11 partners, and we're up to 38 now.
I added this one just because of the moon aspect of it. This was from Space News, by the way, that had this story. And it was interesting because, as you mentioned, I think Slovakia signed the Artemis Accords recently to become one of the newest members in NASA. There was another country as well. And at the same time, you have China reaching out to other folks around the world, too. So you have Nicaragua now, the Arab Union for Astronomy, and this Pacific Space Corporation, which is actually an organization based in Beijing.
You kind of wonder if that counts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, hey, I got my Uncle Fred to sign up.
The reason I bring this part up is because in addition to this international outreach, which we've seen in the past, because China has said that they want to cooperate with Russia as well on this research project, this research base on the moon, they actually released a very interesting video, and I didn't have time to find it. It was on Twitter to add it in here, but maybe we'll add the link in after we're done, where they show what, like, all of the Chinese astronauts on the moon, a vast kind of metropolis moon base. And I think in the background, there was a space shuttle, an actual space shuttle.
Oh, there was a space shuttle without any support structure or external tank taking off in the background. Yeah, it was kind of weird.
Yeah, yeah. So,
you need a glider on the moon, right?
Yeah, but it just shows that they are trying to push the international aspect of it all. I will, though, be interested to see if that international part factors into the Tiangong space station, to see if we see an international crew member or someone on like a crew rotation. So you only have two Chinese astronauts and maybe one partner from these countries that flies up to Tiangong, you know, is there for rotation and returns back to Earth. You know, that'll be very interesting to see how this new program, or not this new program, but this moon program builds on the space station, because they have that asset up there right now.
Well, it's interesting because the ILRS, as we like to call it, started as international between them and Russia.
Yeah.
And yet, and they bought the Shenzhou spacecraft, you know, the original drawings and design for it from Russia. And yet we have not seen a cooperative flight on Tiangong yet, have we?
No, not yet.
Or
not yet.
Shenzhou either.
But speaking of space debris, there was a Shenzhou orbital module that burned up over the West Coast that lit up the skies over California. So there, we were just talking about debris. There is that too. But it, you know, right now Russia is in their partnership. Roscosmos is in their partnership with the International Space Station. Unless there's some sort of really easy way to team up for Tiangong as part of like an early partnership, for this moon program. It'll be interesting to see how that factors in, because Russia's kind of locked in to the space station project, the ISS project right now, until it's done in 2030 or so.
Well, or until they say they're done.
Until they say they're
done. Which they have intimated a few times. No, we're going to leave next week. All right. We are going to go to a break because we live full, exciting lives, and we'll be back in just a moment. So go nowhere. So let's talk about Starliner.
Starliner!
One of my favorite topics to malign. Thank God you're an optimist.
I am. I'm such an optimist that I have the T-shirt. For folks that are just listening, I've got this Atlas V Starliner.
Well, stand up and display it for us.
Well, okay. We'll see if I can stand up.
I'm going to move
the mic a little bit. And then
don't hurt yourself.
Yeah. We'll see. Maybe I can. Oh, my gosh. I don't have a lot of room here. So I'll stand up a little bit. You can see.
Atlas V Starliner.
There you go. So,
because we like to fly our capsules on rockets we don't make anymore. That's cool.
Well, no. They've got enough. At least for the NASA contract.
Yeah, so. I think they stacked up, what did they say, 16 of them or something? They've got a bunch of Atlases left, yeah.
Because it's not just for NASA. ULA has to have the United Launch Alliance has to have the Atlas V rockets for all of their commits for the government, for their customers, and then also for Starliner, of which they need at least six. So, well, seven, actually, because this upcoming flight is the crew flight test, not to be confused with the operational six missions that they have to deliver. So
please expand on that. That'll be our kickoff. So we have an upcoming flight in just a few days.
That's right.
Cross, knock wood. That, if I could put here. Here we go.
So basically, after, oh my gosh, it seems like nearly a decade of, you know,
it selection. Has been a decade. Yeah.
Oh, that's
over
right.
A decade. 2014. It's been 12 years. No, it was 2012, I think.
Was it that? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, so SpaceX is one of two companies that NASA picked to be their commercial crew, their space taxi services for astronauts on the International Space Station.
Right.
They were picked alongside, Boeing was picked alongside SpaceX for a certain number of flights. It's like a block number. So Boeing has six flights to fly, and SpaceX, I think it's... like 14?
They had six, then it got expanded. But what's important here, so this was first kind of tossed down, was originally in 2010, but I think contracts landed later. But what I enjoyed oh so much was that NASA and the government turned to SpaceX and say, we're going to give you $2.6 billion over time.
That's right.
And SpaceX went, yay. And then they turned to Boeing, who's been at it much longer and actually built much more of this kind of hardware at the time, and said, we're going to give you $4.2 billion.
Well, to be clear,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Because there is a very clear disconnect there. Those awards were based on bids that the companies put in. So SpaceX put in the bid of $2.6 billion for the service that they said they were going to give. And then Boeing put in their bid as well. And the reason that's important is because the decision process did get a release. I'm not sure if we're going to talk about it here, but Gwynne Shotwell said that if she had known what Boeing was going to bid, she would have bid a lot higher for their version of the contract. Because, you know, it's essentially the same service, and also SpaceX was able to get there faster and whatnot. But
which is interesting, given that they got almost half the money, that they arrived there quicker. But I do understand what you're saying about about Gwynn and company. And of course, if you could bid higher and you know, still think you'd get the job, you would. I'm just saying, as an external observer, I admire the fact that they got there and beat the pants off of Boeing, quite frankly, for almost half the money. I mean, that shows something about commitment. It shows something about innovation. It shows something about their vertical manufacturing capability. And probably as much as anything, and this is not a knock on Boeing at all. It's actually, you know, my sympathies, not being shareholder owned, I think makes a huge difference.
And I think you're right on all of those points here. So for just to kind of set the stage, the reason that we're talking about Starliner is because in just over 10 days or so, about 10 days, on May 6th is when Boeing will launch their first crewed flight test, a crew, C-R-E-W-E-D.
It's a tough one, isn't it?
I make sure that people don't think that I'm kind of knocking them. This is their first astronaut flight for NASA. It has two astronauts aboard that we'll talk about later. Veterans both, and it follows two previous uncrewed flight tests, OFT-1, Orbital Flight Test 1, which flew in 2019, which was not a success, and Orbital Flight Test 2, which flew in 2021. Is that about right? 2022. Which was a success for the most part, but then there was a substantial bit of redesign work that was required to get the crewed version ready. The crew arrived yesterday, so they are on track. And in fact, this week, NASA and Boeing, I keep wanting to say SpaceX because they fly so many astronauts all the time, but NASA and Boeing gave the green light, essentially the go in their flight readiness review meeting, actually yesterday as well, last evening, to say that they're ready to go. And that's a really big milestone because it means, that's why we're having this podcast discussion now, it means that Boeing is finally ready to fly astronauts. The launch is going to be out of Space Launch Complex. I believe it's 41 at Cape Canaveral, Space Force Station, with a liftoff time on a Monday night. May 6th is a Monday at 10, I think it's 54 p.m. off the, make sure that that's correct. But it's in the evening. It's just before 11 o'clock at night. Interesting for a first crewed flight that they're picking a nighttime launch because you would think they would want as much, but that's how the mechanics work. Sometimes when they pick these flights themselves. So it's been a long road for Starliner, a long road. And they're finally where they are. Now there are some final, I's to dot, some final T's to cross. They're looking at making sure they understand all of the little ins and outs of the vehicle. They're, you know, weighing some parachute studies just to make sure that everything is ready to go. But they are confident that they'll be ready to go, and they're starting to look at the weather and everything for the launch. We'll get more news on that next weekend as they get closer to the flight itself. But that's where we are right now.
And, by golly, if I was an astronaut, I would want them to be concerned about the parachute shrouds for sure.
Oh yeah.
I just would like to back up a step and mention that commercial crew was first proposed in 2010, and they wanted at least two providers so that they weren't dependent on just one system to get astronauts up to the International Space Station. Because, of course, at that point, you're phasing out the shuttle, and we knew we were going to be spending a number of years shoveling money into Soyuz capsules in Russia to send
more and more money
to send our astronauts up to the space station that we primarily paid for. And that started at, there was a huge, I think it started at 36 million and ended up at 86. Have I got that right?
It went up.
Insane.
It went up. When I started, you know, midway through that program, I think the cost for a seat on Soyuz was on the average of 70 million by that point. This is like 2000, you know, the program been going on for a number of years, and it swelled up to nigh on $90 million a seat on a Soyuz vehicle.
In a capsule that barely has enough elbow room for you to blow your nose. I mean, it's really, really crowded in there, which is not a factor, but nonetheless, it the promise was strained, if not broken, and it became a very abusive relationship, and we know those aren't good. Well, so
because there was no other choice, right? The space shuttle retired in 2011, and now there's this 8-year, you know, gap or whatever it was, 9-year gap, where you don't have an option. And the sad part is, you knew it was coming, Rod. I knew that the gap was coming. It's why in 2004, they said they were going to have a replacement up in time for that gap. And then they had nothing because they never funded all of the development for what became.
Well, they Orion. Being Congress.
Yeah. Congress, pardon me. Congress didn't really didn't fund it properly. Funding. And so you never got the rockets and the spacecraft that NASA said that they needed. And so you end up having this gap. And so they were to avoid that in the future.
The original contract included Sierra Nevada, who ultimately was not selected. So they just selected SpaceX and Boeing. And as we pointed out, gave unequal distribution of funds. As you point out, that's what they asked for. So that's what they got. I still got to say, though, you know, I'm impressed with the speed and the success that SpaceX had in a very short period of time, because it is hard to build these things.
It is.
You know what? We've been doing this since 1960.
And that I want you to really make it clear. There is a reason why there was a lot of confidence in 2012 or so
in Boeing,
because of the track record. Boeing, primary or a major contractor on the International Space Station, major contractor on space shuttle work, major contractor in all space.
Saturn V.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there is a legacy of performance that is included in the decision making about, yes, this is a contractor we've worked with for many, many years. So they will have they get that kind of benefit, right? Whereas SpaceX was at that time, you know, they didn't launch, they hadn't even landed a rocket, right, for reusable this, let alone flying anything crew rated, they had a lot of claims for that. And so that's kind of the environment. It's hard to look back now because SpaceX just landed their 300th rocket this week, you know? Right. So to try to compare them as apples and apples, but, you know, they had a little bit of a flipped comparison back then because SpaceX was still relatively new in the flight rate. I think they were only 5 years into Falcon 9 launches by that point.
What, by the time their contract was awarded?
Well, between 2004 to 2012, they had launched Falcon 1 and
I don't think Falcon 1 succeeded until 2008. So Falcon 9 was, still kind of just crawling along.
Because the first one was in 2010, right? Something around that
time. Yeah. So this was a huge vote of confidence on the part of Charlie Bolden, and frankly enabled and championed by Lori Garver, without whom it probably wouldn't have happened, his associate. All right. Well, we've got a lot more to discuss about this, and we'll do that right after this break. So to continue the comparison, SpaceX has flown crew. They're coming up on eight flights, right?
I think they've flown the crew eight flight. The crew eight mission, the crew eight astronauts are up there right now.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
seven or eight. So that, you know, if you're Boeing, you've got a long way to go. And by the way, I meant to mention that Boeing was also considered, in addition to commercial crew, they were considered for the commercial resupply or commercial cargo contract. But I don't know which side backed out of that. It wasn't clear in the article I was looking at. I think it was intimated that it was NASA that said, yeah, we'll just let you do crew. But that might be because they were letting them build the SLS as well. Mm-hmm. I suppose that's always a factor. But Boeing is scheduled for 6 flights, SpaceX for a total of 14. And we expect SpaceX's contract to be extended. So I guess the big question, and I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but the big question for me is, will Boeing fly out their 6 flights and say, okay, never again with a space capsule? Or will they, you know, pick it up and say, oh, this is an okay business, let's keep going?
Well, it's very funny that you mentioned that, because that was a question that was hot on all of the reporters' minds yesterday during the flight readiness review. Mark Nappy, Boeing's kind of, you know, project lead for Starliner, did confirm things that he has said before, and that John Shannon, former NASA space shuttle official now at Boeing too, have both said that the business, well, John Shannon said, I think recent, like last year, that the business case is kind of, they have to see what it is for Starliner. But Mark Nappy said both this week and back in March, when Boeing and NASA kind of rolled out the red carpet to the public at Johnson Space Center to kind of go through all of the different stages, that Boeing is super committed right now to the Starliner program for NASA, to commercial crew for NASA, and in a microcosm, to crew flight test one, this one mission. They said just yesterday that the lives of the astronauts, Sonny Williams and Butch Wilmore, are at stake, and they take it super seriously. And so that's what they're saying they're focused on. They do have the Atlas V rockets to fly them out. They have the Starliner vehicles. I think they're building the third one. They're in the middle of building the second one right now, and they're prepping materials for the fourth vehicle, I believe is what they said back in March. That being said, they say, they're committed to that. They're not saying any other additional use for it, which is different than what we're seeing with SpaceX.
Well, and which is a change to what they originally said, which was exactly. That they saw multiple use cases for this thing.
In fact,
but that's not entirely their fault. I think part of that's because space tourism, while it has grown from zero, which is where it was, it's not quite what they had hoped, maybe.
Yeah, and just to give our listeners a bit of a refresher, NASA was not the only customer that Boeing was targeting for Starliner. And we should point out that Starliner is like the kind of public relations name. It was originally billed as the CST-100, Commercial Space Transport 100, so number right. one, basically. And their other tenant, their commercial tenant, was at the time Bigelow Aerospace, which was led by Las Vegas-based hotel magnate Robert Bigelow. He was developing inflatable space station habitats. He launched two private ones called Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and in fact launched a private inflatable room to the space station, which is still up there now, even though the company itself closed down during the pandemic and just kind of, you know, went away. I believe its assets were picked up by and know-how by Sierra Space and a few others that are developing inflatable habitats. Anyway, the whole point was that Robert Bigelow was going to build private space stations, and they needed a way to get there, and Boeing was building a way to get there, and they were going to kind of combine to have a private approach for scientists, for the public, et cetera, to do it. And so you had those two different services, and that private one kind of fell behind because, like you were saying, the space tourism push on the space station front did slow tremendously and it hasn't been realized even now, right? There aren't private space stations. There's a lot planned, and Boeing may still decide that they want to get into that later on if they have the Atlas boosters or some other booster they could pop a Starliner on top of. So.
Yeah, and it is designed. So just let's talk a little bit about Starliner, and then we'll jump to another break. It is designed to fly primarily on the Atlas V, but can also fly on the Vulcan. And I suppose, was there ever any talk about it flying on SpaceX rockets?
I think that if they had like a need, they would figure out a way. That's an adapter question. Right. And we have seen the precedent for that with Northrop Grumman and the Cygnus spacecraft, right? Because that was designed to fly on Antares rockets. They're redesigning the Antares rocket to, you know, have a U.S. engine. And so now they're flying the Cygnus vehicles on SpaceX rockets. And so if they had a need case and they found like a financial partnership that was agreeable to them, you can bet that Boeing would figure out a way to get there. So,
okay, and it's slightly bigger than the Dragon at 390 cubic feet. I think Dragon is 335, and the Apollo capsule was about 240 cubic feet, I think. I meant cubic feet. So this is significantly larger, and of course, I think you've been inside a Dragon.
I've been inside a Starliner mockup. Yeah, it feels.
Okay, I've been inside the Dragon, not the Starliner. But it feels big enough on the ground to us. But if you're in space and you're floating around, everybody that experiences that says, oh, it's a lot bigger when you're weightless.
And one thing that that Boeing has said is that they have a novel seat stow system, which SpaceX does not. Those seats just stay there, you know, on Crew Dragon. They're fixed seats. But Starliner is supposed to have these collapsible seats. And I remember them specifically saying that we were not allowed to take video or images of how the seats could fold or even like how they're set up, because apparently like it's really proprietary at that point in time, just because they wanted to kind of keep that part secret. But it's supposed to give them a lot more room inside, and it does
have impressive, but it's not doing anybody any good on the ground. I'm sorry. Well, just had to say that.
All right.
So, but one other thing that I would point out, both for Starliner as well as for Dragon, when we're talking about comparison, is that they were originally designed to carry more people than they're going to carry.
Right.
The original
up to
commercial,
seven, right?
Yeah. The original commercial crew was up to seven because the whole plan would be they would have seven people or seven US segment personnel on the space station at a time. They would need a way for all of them to be able to get out in an emergency. Now we see the station having max complements of about seven or so, but both SpaceX and Boeing's vehicles are going to carry on the average four people per flight. And then the rest, you know, those three other potential human body slots, you save for cargo, for supplies, for the other things that you wanted to deliver to the space station. And you can still do more of that than you could on a Soyuz. So,
all right, we are going to take a short break. And when we come back, Tarek, I want you to talk about some of the problems they've had, which include the aero skirt, the need for an aero skirt, which wasn't originally there, and a mile of flammable wire wrap tape.
Yes.
Parachutes. And software. Can I say it with a drum roll? Well, software and valves. Because valves are a big one. Many, many valves. Okay, we'll be right back. Stand by. So let's talk about the issues with Starliner, because they have been many, many delays, many issues. And, you know, it's I wouldn't call it quite ironic. I guess I'd call it indicative. But these problems kind of seem to be running temporally, time-wise, in parallel, roughly, with 737 MAX issues. Mm-hmm. And a lot of industry observers feel that this kind of was predicated by Boeing's move of management away from Seattle to Kansas City.
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting to see the kind of, what was that, the symmetry between the troubles that Boeing had with the Starliner development and the test flights in particular, and of course the tragic issues that they had with the 737 MAX, where you had those fatal crashes, the investigation, and all of that, and I think that it was a very hard lesson to learn. It does sound, at least from the way that we're hearing from Boeing in these announcements and these lead up to this most recent mission, as well as to the last test flight, OFT-2, the second, the kind of redo of their first test flight.
On their money, by the way.
Yeah, on their money. Yeah, they had to pay for all of
it. Taxpayer, relax. You didn't have to pay for that one.
They did get, I think, a little bit of extra NASA money to kind of hold them over. But they seem to be a lot more careful and a lot more in depth in the testing. And it's why they kept finding new things between all these test flights, you know, instead of just kind of pushing through them. You know, you mentioned the aero skirt. That was it's kind of like a ring that goes around the bottom of the capsule. It makes it look kind of
like a round cheese grater.
Exactly.
Got a bunch of holes drilled in it.
And that's designed because they realize that the spacecraft needs a little bit more stability during flight, so that doesn't buff it around, as I understand it. I mean, is that your take too, Rod?
Yeah.
I think
air was spilling around the edges, because the capsule's wider than the top of the rocket by a fair margin. So my understanding is that air was spilling around it and banging into the booster.
So that they had to develop that. And then when it came to, so that was, you know, that was one, but it took them a long time to figure out all this stuff. And in December of 2019, that was the first crewed flight. That was one of the, you know, to the public, the first big issue came to light, because when they launched that mission, and I was on an airplane when, you know, going back to visit family for the holidays when that happened. And, you know, I think they were like 2 minutes away from launch as we took off. And I was like, well, it looks like everything's fine. And by the time we landed, it was like the mission is irrecoverable. You know, we're never going to get to the space station, because they had a flight software issue that Boeing had developed portions of the flight software, like the part to get off the ground, the part for spacecraft separation, the part for these rendezvous, but they hadn't tested it from start to finish, all the way to the end. And because of that, it just didn't gel properly. And
well, so there was an 11-hour shift in its timing clock. So it thought, rather than being at docking, I think it was preparing to re-enter.
Yeah.
Which is not what you want to do when you're headed for the space station.
Oops. Yeah. And then there was also another thing that they found in the ensuing investigation for that. So by the time they got to orbit, they were not on a flight path that they could reach the space station. So the mission was called off and it landed a few days later, back on the ground. And we'll talk about landing in a bit.
But let me just ask, I actually saw an article, I don't remember if it was space.com or Space News, that referred to that first test flight as in effect being suborbital, which was not my understanding. They were at orbital velocities.
They were at orbital velocity because they had to actually do a reentry burn.
Thought it was doing a suborbital mission.
It thought it was coming back to Earth. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so
that was weird.
Because they orbited the Earth for a few days before coming back to Earth. They just couldn't get to the space station because of the issues that they had had. But they also found a second issue in the staging process, you know, in the software that could have led to the spacecraft actually getting hit by the booster after separation because of the issues. And they narrowly avoided that, which was, you know, a big dodge. And Boeing has said that the computer software issue that they had had in that first flight, that's something that if they had had a crew on board, they would have been able to flick some buttons. Hey, this is not correct. We're going to push this in, and they would have actually been able to do that. So that is actually, I think, an important point to put.
It's good to know, but should they have to?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, really, you know, it's sorry to interrupt, but this is something that we, the big collective, the American side of things, have been doing since 1960-61. It's well understood. I know that the money is less than it was during the space age. I get that, but you know, testing your software was seen to be pretty basic, just like, and I'm not being glib here, but just like making sure that your valves don't rust and corrode because they're exposed to humidity and have hypergolic fuels behind them when they're going to be sitting in Florida for weeks at a time on a launch pad right next to the ocean. So this is what I think has me and a lot of other people scratching their heads. You know, if you've worked at a big corporation, if you've ever been a president of a company or an upper management, you know that there's always more to this than meets the eye, including human factors. You know, Cindy and Fred don't get along. So the next thing you know, something goes wrong because somebody's trying to make somebody look bad. I mean, all kinds of stuff can happen. I'm not saying anything specific. I'm just saying there are weaknesses in the human management and performance chain to consider. But you know, for Boeing and Rocketdyne to have to get into an arm wrestling match over who's going to pay for making valves that won't corrode when they're exposed to sea air, which is not the proven reason, but it's the suspected one, is weird when you've been doing this for well over half a century.
You're really on this valve thing. We haven't even gotten there yet. You're really on.
Well, but because we had that problem with 13 valves, that's a bunch, either not opening or not opening fully during that run up to that test flight.
Yeah, to the second test flight, right?
Yeah, which is nuts.
Yeah, so this is another issue that I think I'm gonna skip ahead to this one just because
I'm beating on it like nobody's.
So that was one thing, and that was a very hard lesson for Boeing to learn. And I'm gonna say that they've learned it because here we are, you know, less than 2 weeks away from a crewed flight with all everything fairly signed off at this point. It's a painful lesson to learn, but they did learn that. And that was, I suspect that it was very much an operational thing that Boeing thought that, you know, it would be fine to test the software in these little micro, bits, because if it checks out there, it should check out together. But you would hope that eventually they would do an end to end run. Now they do that. Right. And at least in as much as they can for the new ones for OFD2. Now, they had to actually go back to redo that test flight because they said they were going to do an uncrewed test flight before they do a crewed flight.
Right.
And that was what they flew in 2022. It took them nearly 3 years. Now, it took them 2 years and like a month, basically, because that first one was in December. When they were ready to fly, but they had a lot of issues because it was on the pad for so long. And as you mentioned, they had these valves that all got stuck and it kept delaying the flight. They had, No, maybe. Because they did try to launch, and then they scrubbed the launch because they had the stuck valve. And then they went in, and then it took a long time. They had to replace the valves themselves and whatnot to get through it. Now they've got a valve redesign. This is what Boeing has said in the recently, that they expect to implement on the Starliner, I believe, 3 mission. So this or Starliner 2. So Starliner 1, the operational flight, and this flight don't have the new valves. They just have ones that they know shouldn't corrode over time. But they found out that those valves were susceptible to the corrosion when they're on the pad or just in the ocean environment off the coast of Florida, which is where, you know, Cape Canaveral is on the middle of the state, over a long period of time. And so that was an unwelcome surprise. But you were talking about SpaceX earlier. Do you remember those early Falcon flights had to fly out of Amalek Island out in the middle of the Pacific? And corrosion was a really big challenge for them, too, in that harsh kind of sea environment, too. It was, you know, this is something that that can happen. And I think it's kind of... it's kind of like kicking them while they're down to say, hey, we've been launching these things for like decades. And why can't they build one that can't survive it? You know, at the end of the day, they have been, and the sea will do what the sea does, which is kind of eat away at everything. Right. I think that they now know what they have to do to fix it. And the new ones will have that going forward.
Okay. We have to go to an ad, but let me just add 2 points. When SpaceX had those problems in 2008, they're a brand new rocket company, about 6 years old, who had never done this before, working with guys who were, you know, they were engineers, but they were kind of amateurs largely in terms of this kind of business, as opposed to having built rockets since 1960, as I keep beating on. So I just will give them that. Not being a SpaceX fanboy, just saying, you know, you expect, I think what I'm getting at here, and then I'll give it up, is, you know, there should be this load of experience that comes along with being a long-standing major old school aerospace contractor that's built fighter planes, that's built the B-17, that's built rockets, you built, you know, the 747, for God's sake, and very well, by the way. I mean, they were an incredible company for decades. And then to be brought down by stuff that seems this obvious to people like us is kind of embarrassing.
I get it, Rod. But remember, it's not just Boeing, right? There's a reason why it took 18 years to build a new rocket at NASA, when this is the company that put people on the moon and built 3 different types of crewed spacecraft on 3 different launch systems within 9 years. And then it took 18 years to just build a new rocket. You know, it's a very similar story. You know,
yeah. But who built that new rocket?
Well, okay.
All right. So let me just one more correction. Boeing ULA have set aside 7 Atlas rockets to fly out the contract. So I guess that's just for the for Starliner.
It's 6 operational flights to 1 crewed flight.
Okay. We will be right back. Go nowhere. Cue it up, buddy.
All right. Yeah. All right. We have one more big hurdle that I wanted to make sure that we mentioned, because this is one that actually came up after that second test flight. And I think we agreed it was 2022. I have to go back and read. and that was the fact that Boeing and NASA did announce that when they were doing final checks, actually, there were 2 other issues. Number 1 was a parachute issue. The loading was incorrect on the earlier flights, in that if there was an issue where one of the parachutes on the reentry for Starliner didn't deploy, the lines weren't rated to handle the weight in an off nominal situation. So they had to do a parachute redesign, which they have done, but that took a lot of extra time, to build in, which is why the mission's been delayed a bit since last year. And then they found out after the fact, and this one I think is a little egregious. And I agree with you, Rod, in terms of like, they should have known better. They found out that the tape, the Kapton type tape that they have in a lot of the wiring on the inside of the spacecraft, was flammable. after they built the spacecraft. And so they had to go in
a mile of it,
a mile of tape, 5,280 feet of tape in that. Ooh,
well
inside.
Done.
The, yeah. Yeah. It's one of the,
look at you, in your Imperial measurement memory.
That, that and the fact that the space shuttle had 44 vernier jets, RCS thrusters, with, I think,
how many parts are in the Saturn V?
Okay. Well, no. Okay. I've hit my limit.
Over 3 million.
And so that is something that they had to deal with. And it takes a lot of time to go into the spacecraft and rip that stuff out, make sure that what you can't rip out is going to be safe and covered. Mark Nappy did say that I had to rip out a whole mile of it, like you said, and then go back in. It just adds a lot of time. It's something that you wish you wouldn't have had to do and would have figured that part out in the first place to avoid it all. But they've got it licked now.
The way you said that was kind of cute. Something you wish you had figured out, you know, before you built the spacecraft. Yeah.
and now we have a veteran crew. And it's a very different crew than the one that was named at the outset. And I want to point that out so we can talk about that too. But we have two veterans of both space station and space shuttle flight, Butch Wilmore as the commander, and Sunny Williams, as the pilot for this mission. And they're in Florida right now at the Kennedy Space Center. They arrived yesterday in a T-38 jet along with their backup crew, Mike Fink, and they're just, you know, going through their last days, I guess, on Earth ahead of that launch themselves.
Wait, that doesn't sound right.
Well, no, I didn't mean it in that way, and you know I didn't mean it in that way. So, but they're before the liftoff, the last.
Oh my God!
I don't know.
It's the rapture. Hold on to something. yes, and they're both seasoned flyers. They both have military experience. And they were preceded, however, by Chris Ferguson,
who was
there waiting his turn for a long time. And then finally he said, look, I can't wait for this. I'm not going to do it.
That's right. You know, former NASA space shuttle commander Chris Ferguson was, you know, when he retired from NASA, he went to Boeing and he became like their chief astronaut advisor, you know, helping with the layout of the switches. And they have switches on the Starliner, if memory serves, right? Which is nice and visceral. You love pushing a button and toggling a switch.
Well, as opposed to what you're referring to as glass panel.
Exactly.
Mostly glass panel controls on Dragon, although they do have switches for critical functions, but yeah.
Exactly. The original crew for crew flight tests was actually three people. It was Nicole Mann, and Mike Fink of NASA, and then Chris Ferguson as like the Boeing astronaut. And then when the crew flight kept getting delayed and delayed, Chris Ferguson eventually retired from Boeing. You know, because, you know, he wanted to spend time with his family and whatnot, I would assume. And Nicole Mann was slated to be on an expedition on the space station. So she got shifted to a SpaceX Dragon launch because they were flying pretty regularly by then. And she went and flew that mission. And Mike Fink ended up dropping back to backup crew with Barry, Butch Wilmore, and Sunita Williams then joining on as prime for this one. And he is on Starliner 1 as the commander. So that's the operational mission. And then that whole other crew, that Starliner 1 mission, also got jogged around. Josh Quesada was named for that, as well as Jeanette Epps, NASA astronauts. Both of them have already flown. In fact, Jeanette Epps just launched on a SpaceX rocket on Crew 8. So a lot of juggling because of the delays that caused these crew switches. But Sunny Williams and Barry Wilmore, they've been kind of the core for the last couple of years now. And they've been training and they're getting all ready for it.
Just some notes on the two of them. Barry/Butch Wilmore has a more traditional kind of background, I guess. He had the shuttle flight and a Soyuz flight to the ISS, so two missions up there. He was a Navy test pilot in jets. And known to most of us more recently by being the guy who ordered up the 3D printed ratchet wrench in space, which I never could figure out how you do that in plastic, but there you go. Sunita Williams was also a test pilot, but in helicopters and rotary winged aircraft, which is something you don't see in the astronaut corps very often. Many of them are rated on helicopters, but that's not their principal thing. She had a shuttle and a Soyuz flight as well. Formerly held the record for women for the most spacewalks at 7, and the most spacewalk time at 50 hours, 40 minutes. Of course, these records are there to be broken. But I think meaningfully ran the first space marathon aboard the ISS, which is a lot of time on the Stephen Colbert treadmill.
Oh, no, I don't think it was that treadmill either. She ran the Boston Marathon on like the older treadmill that they used to have, I think. And I remember that was like a whole big thing. They had to make sure that the treadmill would be able to handle a continuous, a continuous marathon. And if memory serves, because she has quite long hair, too, I believe when she launched on that flight, on that expedition, that she donated her hair before flying to like one of those causes that makes the hair for cancer patients and one thing too. And I was really wondering, I was actually asking my team today, I was like, I wonder if she might do that again for this mission too, but I guess we're going to find out.
Well, I'll donate mine. Sunny Williams, if you want to set up a special thing, if somebody wants silver hair.
She was also the second woman to command the International Space Station after Peggy Whitson, actually, too. So these are not, you know, spring chickens. In terms of, or Johnny come latelys, if you will,
says the guy who can't remember how old he is.
Well, I'm not saying that they're old. I'm saying that they're not
newbies.
Exactly. They're not newbies, when it comes to flying in space, nor would you want them to, to be for the first test flight. And Mike Fink as well, their backup, and the Starliner one, crew is another seasoned veteran of International Space Station flights. He's flown on Soyuz as well. And so he also knows his stuff. He actually posted a picture of the launch site. They flew their T-38s over the launch site yesterday as we're recording this during their arrival to the Kennedy Space Station. So this is a very seasoned crew. And I think if you would want anyone on your shakedown crew, these two are the ones that you would want. And in fact, when they landed yesterday, they actually said that they are they're not expecting it to go 100% perfect. In fact, which Wilmore said, do we expect it to go perfectly? Well, hey, it's the first human flight of the spacecraft, so I'm sure we'll find things out. So what those things are, we don't know, but he said, and I quote, that's why we do this. This is a test flight. And when you do test, you expect to find things. And so whatever those things are, it sounds like Butch is on the case.
And may I just say, having worked in and out of public relations, that sounds like a little bit of a prompt, but okay. because that's what they're there for, right?
Not exactly.
And for the public relations people.
And Sunny Williams said that they've been training for every single thing they could possibly think of. She said, and I quote, that they had the kitchen sink thrown at them in all of the different simulations that they've been doing. So that, you know, it just gives her a lot of confidence that they're ready to fly.
But Elon carries around the kitchen sink.
That's right. Twitter. Well, but that's only for Tesla electric cars, right?
No, it's a Twitter.
Oh, Twitter. Yeah, you're right.
Wandered in there. Yeah.
I forgot.
Which he thought was very funny. And the rest of us kind of looked at it like, what's wrong with you, dude?
I had just put the fact that he owns Twitter out of my mind. And now it's back in the front.
Thanks. Yeah. Sorry about
Thanks,
that.
Thanks, Rod. I didn't
mean to pollute your mind. So let's wrap up with just a sketch of the mission. I have it down for a suggested launch. I thought it was May 5th, but I have May 6th through or 7th for an 8-day mission.
Yeah.
Which will land on land. This is not a splashdown.
We didn't talk about
that. The Southwest United States, which is that's another interesting thing. Now, originally, the Crew Dragon was supposed to come down either on be able to do hard land landings or oceanic. And my recollection is that Musk just decided it was a bridge too far for them and not to try for the dry land landing, because you have to have airbags and you have to have braking rockets.
Yeah. And, Dragon was going to have legs, actually. It would use braking rockets.
Oh, that was it.
The full thing.
Because it's reusable. Yeah. You'd want that.
So this is a short flight. This is the crew flight. This is a very short flight. It's a 1 week mission, 8 days, like you said. It launches at night because of what it takes to get to the space station on May 6th. So that like very late at night, overnight, and it will fly up. I think it'll take them about like a day and a half or so to get to the space station while they do some shakedowns. They dock at the space station. That's unlike some of the other cargo ships like Cygnus, they don't get captured by an arm. Right. SpaceX did the same with Dragon. They upgraded it so that it can dock itself and doesn't need to be captured anymore. And then they will make sure that it's performing as expected at the space station. So they'll take a lot of measurements. What's the cabin environment like? Is it is the life support working properly? What's the experience like for the astronauts on the whole thing? And then they'll undock and they'll return to Earth and they will land. And this is interesting and vague because NASA has says they will land in the southwestern United States. Yeah. I don't know why.
So duck and cover, buddy.
I don't know why they don't just say that they're going to land at White Sands in New Mexico, which is where they landed the OFT-2. Or they could say, White Sands or Mojave, right? They could say that too if they wanted to keep that as an option. At Edwards Air Force Base. So, or is it Space Force Base? I'm not sure. But the case is that, like you mentioned, this can land on land and it will parachute down. It will deploy these big airbags and to kind of cushion the final blow after the thrusters that we've seen with Soyuz in the past. And it worked fine.
I characterize it as final blow, but I get what you're saying.
The astronauts have described that landing to me as like a car wreck, like a 10 mile an hour, like you crash into the other car. That's what it feels like in that. And that's what they,
and you know,
that's baseline. So
I've simulated that actually. A friend and I had a car that we didn't care much for when we were in our late teens, early 20s. And just because we were young, stupid men, and that's what young, stupid men did at the time, we deliberately ran it into a brick wall at about 10 miles an hour with us in it, with lap belts only. And I could tell you, it's shocking.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it didn't do much to the car because cars built like tanks those days.
You could have joined the demolition derby and had a much more exciting time driving backwards in a pit.
And probably about the same amount of brain damage as I've got. So I have a note here: if successful, this mission will fully test life support, manual maneuvering, flight, and docking. And if so, operational flights expected to start in 2025.
Yeah,
we'll see.
We'll see for sure. I would like to know a few more things about the mission here, just because it is, like, as we talked about, a brand new vehicle. And that, this is maybe a little kind of twee, Rod, so please forgive me. But I'm very curious if Boeing will let the astronauts name their spacecraft. Because I seem to recall...
You worry about these things.
I seem to recall that they did announce a name for the first one when OFT-2 landed. But now I can't remember it offhand. Maybe Robert Perlman at Collect Space will know.
They should name it Billy.
Well, and then the Juanita other question
or something. Yeah.
The other question there is, are there going to be any new traditions for this spacecraft? Because there are new traditions for SpaceX about how they go out there and marvel at the rocket, how they go up to the thing.
Well, let's hope they aren't the traditions the Russians have for when they launch their rocket. And I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
I whatever do you mean, Rod, at all? I don't know if we should enlighten that, because that feels very vague.
Well, I think this is the kind of thing where we should have a contest. It's like, okay, listeners, because you're falling down the job when it comes to sending space jokes, not all of you, but most of you, go ahead and send us what you know. No fair looking it up. What is the tradition for Russian cosmonauts before they board any Russian spacecraft to go into space? It started back at the beginning of the program, and we don't have any prizes, so you'll just
hint, though? Because there's actually quite a lot. There's quite a lot of other...
The one that happens right at the launch pad.
Yeah, the one between the bus ride out.
Yeah, okay. Don't get too specific. Don't make it too easy.
All right.
Are we done here?
I think so.
Okay.
So, mark your calendars, space fans, May 6th. Hopefully not rain or shine, but we'll see how this goes. The two final points, they are looking at the weather. They are also looking at weather for landing, because they need to make sure that they have good weather for reentry and landing too. And Mark Nappy, of Boeing, for Starliner program, said that this spacecraft is designed to stay at the space station for up to 40, 45, 48 days or so. They can stay up there, in terms of consumables. So they've got about a month and a half of margin, depending on how long, and they don't expect that the mission's going to take that long at all. But we were talking about
it's hard to see a storm that long, and ultimately it's supposed to be able to stay there for 6 months.
Oh yeah, for the operational flights, for sure.
Yeah.
So mark your calendars. You know, plan to stay up late or get up super early, depending on your time zone. And hopefully we'll see something special with Boeing and their first Starliner crew flight.
I'll just call you the next day. All right, everybody. Thanks for joining us today for episode 108 of This Week in Space on Boeing Starliner. Don't forget to check out space.com, website to the name, and the National Space Society and NSS.org. Tarek.
Yes.
Where can we find you wringing, clutching your pearls over the Boeing launch?
Well, you can find me.
I had trouble getting that out.
You can find me at space.com as always, getting very excited for this flight. Our writer, Elizabeth Howell, please follow her on Twitter, Howell Space. She will be at the launch for us for this one. So it should be really, really exciting. And you can find me on the Twitter too at Tarek J. Malik. If you like space video games, sci-fi games, you can find me on the YouTube at Spacetron Plays. That's all one word. And tonight, you just might find me at the movie theater to go watch Alien, the Ridley Scott classic, because today, April 26th, for this episode, is Alien Day. 45 years ago, that movie came out, and I'm going to go take my teenage daughter to go see a space horror classic, hopefully, tonight.
And I read that. I was going to mention that. Thank you for doing so. I will just say, if they were showing Aliens in the theater, I'd be there to see it three times. Alien, I can kind of take a pass on, because I've seen enough Black Cat movies, you know, where they jump out from behind the partition is there.
It's okay though, Rod, because you know, in space, no one can hear you scream.
Like, yeah. okay. And of course you can find me at pilebooks.com or at astromagazine.com. And if you're in or around Los Angeles, I'll be appearing more times than anybody wants me to at the International Space Development Conference on May 23rd to 26th, which Tarek will not be coming to because he has other things to do. I know it's Memorial Day weekend. I get it. We're bad. But I'll be all over the program there and winning my first major award in some time. Well, at least major. Yeah. So, hey, if you roll by, come and say hello. And of course, you can always drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We welcome your comments, suggestions, ideas, insults, jokes, rotten fruit. But don't put it in the mail, please. But we do like getting your comments. We answer each and every email. Wow, somebody needs to give me a new job. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher. So make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, give us reviews. We'll take 5 stars or better, please. And don't forget, you can get all the great programming with video streams on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit. Only $7 a month. Even Tarek could afford that.
Wow. As well as some extras
that are only available there. You've heard Leo talk about the tough time facing podcasters. This is your chance to step up and be counted. So join us and ignore that car that just drove by behind me. You can also follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter and on Facebook and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Tarek. Happy birthday. You're almost as old as me now.
Oh, see everybody thank next you, bro. Week. I love you, man.